Right, good evening, everyone. Good Erev Shabbos. Welcome back to our Three Ideas in 30 Minutes, which Baruch Hashem, as the hot dogs grow, and now we have sauerkraut this week and cholent. And I'm just going to say, even though I know all of you are here for the Ruchnius, there is a correlation between the increase in Gashmius and the increase in attendance. So I'm sure my three Vortlach are beautiful, but obviously can't compare to a good hot dog and cholent at 8:15 on a Thursday night. So obviously everyone's invited to attend. And I want to thank our sponsor for this evening, Marilyn and Michael Fedak, in gratitude for the many weekly learning opportunities at BRS. And we are grateful to the Fedaks for their sponsorship. And as always, our shir is Liuli Nishmasa, Esther Tehila Bas Gavriel Pinchas. Okay, the first idea, I think in our many years of doing this, might be a top five idea. Now, I know that's bold. And usually I only decide if I like the idea after I see the way that it comes out. But I'm telling you, I think this is a top five idea, blew my mind away, and I'm excited to share it with you as well. Pasuk says, of course, we're reading this week's Parsha, that Yosef is in Mitzrayim, and he's coming back one day from being in the fields, and he is seduced by Potiphar's wife, Vayikayom Azev Vayivoa Baisa, so he comes home. La sos malachto, we don't know what that means, but to do his work, and again, Rashi and Chazal have different definitions of what that means. Ve'in ish mi'an she'ya bayis sham bayis, and there's no one in the house. Va'tispeseu bibigdo le'mor shachava yimi. So what happens? Eshes Potiphar grabs onto his coat, and she says, lie with me. So what does he do? Va'yazo bigdo b'yado v'yanas v'yatzechutza. So you almost like envision the scene. She's holding onto his cloak. He says, I gotta get at her. He runs. She stays holding on to his garment, and he's out of there. That's Pashup Shot in the Pasuk. Listen to this unreal reading by a Sefer Dudaim Basadeh, which I saw quoted, and it is unreal. Unreal. So he breaks up the Pasuk. He breaks up the Pasuk. First he says, what does it mean, Vayavoha Baisa? Baita, he says, La sos malachto, what does it mean to do his work? That is, what's the work of a Jew? A work of a Jew is to be an Eved Hashem. Rotzalomar atzadik kishemakri v'atzmo la'avodas habori baruchu b'torah v'tfila umidavik atzmo l'pnimi yishu shorish nismaso. So lavoa baisa lasos malachto means that he's going to be an Eved Hashem. Right? What is the secret to being an Eved Hashem, says the Sefer? How is it that you're going to be an Eved Hashem? So what happens? He comes lasos malachto and all of a sudden v'tispeseu bibigdo. She holds on to his garment. Turn to page number two. The word big dough, he points out, doesn't just mean garment. What does beged or bagad mean in Hebrew? What? To rebel. To rebel. Your act of rebellion, right? We say, what?
Bogad.
Exactly. Bogad. So therefore he says, v'tispeseu bibig dough. You know what the Yetzer Hara does when you want to come and serve Hashem? It grabs onto your beged. It grabs onto that which you rebelled against, those mistakes that you made, or your failures, or your shortcomings. And therefore, on the top of page number two, v'tispeseu bibigdoli mor shachva imi rotzolomar, hazona bishashu misitra dismola. In other words, the Yetzirah, what does it do? Ritzono. Yeah, what is that next word? Lahapil. It wants to make a person fall, ha'adam mimadregaso. In other words, wants to hold you down. How does the Yetzer Hara hold you down? Because it holds on to your mistakes. It holds on to your shortcomings. It holds on to your failures, and it makes you remember them. It says, you want to be a better person? Don't you remember that you've tried this 50 times and you failed every time? You want to be better at showing up in Shacharis on time, Moskowitz, because you somehow always show up at 7:03 and never 7 o'clock? Don't you know you've been trying? You're 40, what, I don't even know how old I'm. 44 years old. You've been doing it. I don't know. There's something about 7:03. I'm yekish about everything else, but somehow my clock is set to 7:03. Moskowitz, you want to keep trying? You've been doing it for 44 years. You've been failing to show up at the dot of early enough to put in your tiles. You think you're going to figure it out going forward? Right? So that's the Itzahara. It holds on to your mistakes. It says, that defines you. That is who you are. Ki ein adam tzadik ba'aretz, because everyone makes mistakes. V'ritzona lahaskiras adam mea begidu shelo. And the Yetzirah wants to remind you over and over and over again your mistakes. Every time you try to change, the Yetzirah says, you've tried this before and you've been unsuccessful. And every time you want to improve, the Yetzirah says, come on, Don't you know you're not that type of person? I'm not the type of person who learns. I'm not the type of person who exercises. I'm not the person who's going to be successful. I can't talk about dieting anymore now that we're all eating hot dogs and sauerkraut at 8:15, and I have to come up with another example. But it's the Yetzer Hara that says, La'haskiras adam me'abigidus. It always reminds you of your shortcomings. It always reminds you of your failings. La'apilo. Why? Because it wants to knock you down again. And every time you dream, and every time you aspire, and every time you commit to more change, the Yetzer Hara comes along and says, Maskut, you've tried this 50 times. You failed 50 times. La'apilo, because it wants to knock me down. La'achna ve'atzvas. And it wants to humble me, and it wants to make me sad. It wants to shatter all of my dreams and all of my aspirations. And that's the tactic of the Yetzer Hara. V'zesha kasa betis b'seo b'bigdo. And that which it means that Ashes Potiphar held onto your beged, Rotzalomar Ochezes Oso Bibigida Shalo. It held on to your failures. It wouldn't let you let go of it. It wouldn't let you leave behind your past failures. And it says, don't hold on to your mistakes. That's what we have to convince ourselves of. It always tries to make you hold on to your mistakes. And therefore it says, Lomar Shachva Yimi Besocha Guf. In other words, it keeps those inside of you. But what does a righteous person do? Margish sheze atzas a Yetzer Hara. It recognizes that that's not you. That's only the Yetzer Hara. Ve'eino choshev ledvarav. It doesn't listen to the Yetzer Hara. But what does it do when the Yetzer Hara tries to vitis b'seo b'bigdo? It tries to get you to hold on to your failures. What does Yosef Atzadik do? Vayazo b'bigdo. What does he do? He runs away. He leaves it behind. He says, leave behind your past failures. Don't hold on to your past mistakes. Don't let your shortcomings define you. But rather, vayazo bigdo. The way to succeed and the way to grow and the way to become a tzaddik is not to let your past mistakes define you, but rather, vayazo bigdo, to let go of it and to be able to move on and to not hold on to your past mistakes and to your past failures. So says the Dudaim Basada. This is what the Pasuk is teaching us about. Yes, it's a story of Yosef and Ashes Potiphar, but it's really a story about what holds us back and the only way to allow ourselves to move forward. What holds us back is this mindset of Vatis Beseu Bibigdo, is that we are constantly being reminded of our failures and our shortcomings and our mistakes, and we allow the Yetzer Hara to convince us that those mistakes define us. But says Yosef HaTzadik that the only way to improve is Vayazov Bigdo, is you got to be willing to let it go. You got to be willing to leave that past failures behind. You have to be willing to not hold on to your past mistakes. You have to be willing to yell back at your Yetzer Hara. I know Moskowitz, for 44 years I show up at 7:03. Tomorrow morning, Bli Neder, I'm going to be at the Sunrise Minyan at the beach. Tomorrow morning, on Sunday morning, when I show up at Minyan, I'm going to be a few minutes early to have my talis and tefillin ready to rock and roll on time. I'm not going to let the Yetzer Hara talk me out of it. I'm not going to let me convince me that I can't succeed, but rather, Vayazov Bigdo. I think this is top five. Psychologists, no? No? Really? You don't have patients that Vatis Paseo Bigdo, that they hold on to their past mistakes?
They do.
You have to recognize it. Well, I think that happens here in the Pasuk.
Right,
Vatis Paseo Bibigdo. But you don't think it's the Yetzer Hara that tries to get you to hold on to it? And then Vayazo Bigdo. I know so many people. I speak for myself. There's so many times that the Yetzer Hara is Vatis Paseo Bibigdo. It reminds you, it almost doesn't allow you to dream and to aspire, because it always says over and over again, you're not that guy, or you've tried a million times. And it's only when you look at yourself and you say Vayazo Bigdo, okay, you're right, 44, whatever it is, but I got to be able to move on. I got to be willing to move on. That's Vayazov Bigdo, Dudaim Basadeh. I think I loved it. It spoke to me. I hope it spoke to you. Obviously not my psychologist friend here, but I don't know. Anyone? I thought this was top five. First of all, it's a beautiful reading of the Pasuk. It's a beautiful reading of the Pasuk. The word beged doesn't just mean clothes, but it means your rebelliousness. It means your failures and your mistakes. And while the Yetzer Hara tries to get you to hold on to it, you have to be willing to let go of it. I think it's a top five. You are welcome to disagree with me if you want. wouldn't be the first time. You can join a long list of people who regularly disagree with them. Most of them are sitting in my house right now. Okay, here we go. Idea number two comes from Rabbi Mordechai Willig, who we were just zoicha to have here twice, actually, in the last couple of months, as his son, Rabbi Yehuda Willig, was anointed. Hachtara, what's an English translation? Appointed? I know what a crown is, but how it bestowed upon with the installed. He was an installation as the Rosh Shiva of Yeshiva South Florida. This is a beautiful idea from Rabbi Willig. Rabbi Willig quotes the Gemara, who says, one who blesses a compromiser, Ken, I always got the English for you now, one who blesses a compromiser such as Yehuda is a blasphemer. In other words, one who compromises, heresy. So what about compromise is heresy? We were always taught that compromise is a beautiful thing. We should want to compromise. Why does the Gemara say that anyone who compromises, like Yehuda, was a blasphemer? So what is the Gemara talking about? The Meshech Chachma suggests the following, that the sons of Bilha and Zilpah did not wish to kill Yosef. That's Rashi. While the four sons of Leah, who were present at the time, Reuven was not there, did want to kill Yosef. Yehuda was the deciding vote. So it's four against four. Do we kill Yosef or do we not kill Yosef? Yehuda has the deciding vote. Had Yehuda insisted that Yosef be returned safely to Yaakov, he would have prevailed by a vote of 5-4. In this context, compromise is indeed reprehensible. Right? So Yehuda gives in. Instead of killing Yosef, they decide to sell Yosef. That's the compromise. And therefore, the Gemara says anyone who compromises like Yehuda is a blasphemer. Now, Rabbi Willig points out that Yehuda does tshuva. When does Yehuda do tshuva? Yehuda does tshuva in a few parshios. When he gets the deal of a lifetime. Remember, the brothers make a deal that whoever steals, what are you going to be able to do? You can put them to death. All of a sudden, they find the goblet in whose baggage? In Binyamin. And Yehuda comes forward, and Yosef, who's the viceroy, says, how about this? I won't kill him. I'll just keep him in jail. Now, that's like the deal of a century. It's a get out of death free card, right? The original deal was we're going to kill him. Then Yosef comes along and says, I won't kill him, only put him in jail. Seems like a pretty good deal. What does Yehuda do? Vayigash elav Yehuda. Yehuda approaches and he says, no deal, no deal. Yet Yehuda forcefully rejects this arrangement, insists that Binyamin be released and offers himself as a slave instead. Furthermore, Yehuda threatens Yosef and is undeterred by the risk of his aggressive posture. This refusal to accept Binyamin's servitude represents Yehuda's tshuva for his earlier blasphemous compromise. So as opposed to our parsha, when Yehuda compromises and he's blamed for compromise, next week's parsha, when he refuses to compromise, that is his tshuva. Then you have another compromise later on. Esav claims that the available grave in Maras Machpelah is his and denies that Yaakov purchased it from him. After negotiations back and forth, the brothers agreed to postpone the burial until Naphtali returns from Mitzrayim with the deed. Chushim, Dan's deaf son, is enraged at the disgrace to his father's body and kills Esav. Chaim Shmuel Levitz explains that the brothers were gradually entrapped into negotiations and compromise and were therefore insensitive to the disgrace of their father's remains. Only Chushim, who couldn't hear the give and take but was suddenly confronted with the reality of the situation, responded to Esav's preposterous position and resulting disgrace of Yaakov's body and acted accordingly. And so therefore you see that first Yehuda makes the mistake, he compromises in an inappropriate fashion. Then he does tshuva with Binyamin, he refuses to compromise. He forcefully rejects the arrangement. And then you see ultimately at the end of Brachos, once again, Esav and Yaakov, Chushim comes along and says, we're not negotiating. There are certain things we could talk about. This isn't one of them. It's like in my house. You know, not everything is a compromise in my house. We sometimes have votes in my house. Let me tell you how they go. Okay? Everyone gets a vote. But there's one problem. And that is that my wife gets 5 votes. Right? So that's how voting goes in our house. Right? Not everything is something. I tell my kids, too bad. Not everything's up to negotiation. Not everything is up to a compromise. But then Rabbi Willig goes on. And he points out that after all, this manifests itself later on. Later on, when Aaron HaKohen, the Jewish people, at Chet HaEgel, and they come to Aaron and they demand that he makes an Egel. And what does Aaron say? Or God. So Aaron compromises and acceded to their request, resulting in the creation of an Egel. And as they wanted idolatry, Aaron HaKohen says, if I could just eke out a couple more hours until Moshe gets back, that's all I need. So he creates a compromise. What was the result of that compromise? He did so either to avoid worse consequence if he would have been killed, or he would stall. But this compromise, like Yehuda's, is deemed blasphemous. Aaron incurred Hashem's wrath and was severely punished. Sometimes, says Rabbi Willig, even silence is a punishable compromise. When Paro plotted to outsmart Am Yisrael and thereby destroy him, he consulted three advisors, Bilam, Yisro, and Eov. Bilam was killed, Yisro fled and was rewarded, and Eov was silent and was sentenced to a painful and agonizing suffering. Eov's compromise seems reasonable. After all, his protest would not have accomplished anything. But Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz interprets that Eov's silence reflected insensitivity. When one is in pain, he cries out, even though the cry will accomplish nothing. For not feeling the pain of others, Eov was sentenced to pain that would cause him to cry. And lastly, the last example is Hanukkah. We are reminded that compromise, a laudable and critical approach, can sometimes be blasphemous. Right? What did the Chashmonaim refuse to do? They refused to compromise. They refused to compromise on their values. They refused to compromise on their faith. They refused to compromise on their passion. And therefore, says Rabbi Willig, there is a time for everything. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time for war and a time for peace. As we've seen above, there is much room for error when deciding whether to give time, when a given time demands that one compromises or stand on principle. May our Torah leaders, etc. So what do I love about this idea? I love about this idea because I think it speaks a lot to what many of us struggle with, which is, when do we compromise in our values, and what values should never be compromised on? And that is the struggle of so many modern Jews, that we are constantly in a world where we're being asked to compromise on our values, where we are being asked to compromise on what is so important to us, where Western values and Western civilization are constantly bombarding us and telling us that Judaism is outdated and archaic, and therefore it has to bend and mold to modern sensitivities. And we're left wondering, what is it that we compromise on, and what is it that are the line in the sand, that these are our values that I will never compromise about? And this, I believe, is a very important conversation. It's a very healthy Shabbos table conversation to have with children and grandchildren as we approach the holiday of Hanukkah, to wonder to yourself, the Chashmonaim were willing to fight for their values, right? Esther, in the story of Purim, Leich Knosas Kol Yudim, Shloshes Yamim, Esther said, this is the line in the sand. Up until that point, Esther, so to speak, the hidden Jew. Now she had, the rubber meets the road. You're either with us or you're not. You're either a Jew or you're not. And Esther has to stand forward. She says, I'm not going to tolerate this anymore. And I believe Jews are being challenged with this in our day and age as well. As Jewish pride is being challenged, and as being openly Jewish is being challenged, especially on college campuses, as politicians and pundits keep on moving the needle about what is acceptable and what is not acceptable in discourse. And we're left wondering, is there time to speak out? Should we compromise? Should we find a middle ground? Or are there certain lines in the sand that we, as religious, orthodox, God-fearing Jews, say, this is what we stand for. Love us or hate us, this is what we stand for. These are our values, and we are not willing to compromise on it. So I love this idea by Rabbi Willig's, because first of all, I think it is such a powerful example. Throughout Tanakh, he really took us throughout Bereishis, Shmos, and ultimately certain Midrashim, to the story of Hanukkah, showing that one of the tensions that plays out throughout the Torah is, when is it healthy to compromise and when is it not healthy to compromise? In interpersonal relationships, oftentimes, very healthy to compromise. You're in a fight with a neighbor, you're in a fight with a spouse, with a child, with a family member. 9.5 out of 10 times, the answer is going to be compromise, compromise, compromise. And when you're not willing to compromise, and when people dig their feet in the sand, that's when relationships are torn apart and family members don't speak for years. It is toxic and it is destructive. And yet when it comes to our Judaism, when it comes to our values, when it comes to our faith, when it comes to the things that we're most passionate about, then we have to be willing to draw a line in the sand. And I think it's healthy and appropriate for you to converse with your children and grandchildren about what is so important to you that you are not willing to compromise on. Think about how many people, how many stories we hear. I know I have in my family, of family members in the 20s and the 30s or the 40s or the 50s, who the defining characteristic about their parnassa wasn't about how much money they made. No one remembers the paycheck. No one even remembers what they did. But how many stories is the defining characteristic of grandparents and great-grandparents? The only thing I know about their work was they used to get fired every Shabbos. They used to get fired every Friday. No one knows how much they paid. All that mattered was that there was a value that they were unwilling to compromise on. And that is the legacy that they left for generations to come. Not how many zeros were on the paycheck. Not the type of car that they drove. There was one defining characteristic that so many of us remember grandparents and great-grandparents by, and that was that there was one value called Shabbos, and it was non-negotiable. And even if they got fired every Friday and had to find a new job every Sunday, they were willing to do it because that was the line in the sand they would not compromise on. And so in our day and age, when so much comes easy, and so much is handed to us on a silver platter, and we are, Baruch Hashem, overwhelmed with a sense of affluence and acceptance in society, we also have to be careful to make sure that we know that there are certain values that we are not willing to compromise on. That is idea number two, a beautiful idea from Rabbi Willig. So idea number one was what to hold on to and what to let go. Idea number two is what should be compromised on, what should not. Idea number three comes once again from Rav Weinfeld, my dear friend Rabbi Bogopolsky, in the beautiful Sefer that he gifted me last week, Timely and Timeless, I believe it's called. And here he makes a beautiful suggestion based on a medrash. Rashi, when listing all of the generals of Esav, in our Parsha now listing the lineage of Yosef, so it's striking because they dwarf us in numbers. So the Rashi quotes a medrash. And the medrash says as follows. A flax merchant was coming in with his camel laden with flax. The blacksmith wondered, where can all this flax fit? There was one wise person who answered him. One spark can emerge from your bellows and burn it all. So too Yaakov saw all the chieftains listed above and wondered and said, who can conquer them all? What is written below? This is the lineage of Yaakov Yosef. And it is written, in the house of Yaakov will be as fire, and the house of Yosef as a flame, and the house of Esav as straw. One spark will emerge from Yosef to burn them all. So clearly it's a discussion, it's a conversation that Yaakov has internally, where he looks at how many they are and how few he is, and he says, how in the world am I supposed to defeat them? Israel is surrounded by seven countries that dwarf us in size and in the number of people and in the size of their armies for the last 80 plus years, right? So Yaakov, we are Yaakov. We look out there and we say, how is it that we're going to survive? They so much outnumber us. So the Pasuk says, okay, don't worry, because they're the flax and you're the fire, and therefore you're going to burn them down. So says Rav Weinfeld, this parable is difficult to comprehend. The blacksmith wondered how the flax merchant can bring all of the flax inside. Of what relevance is it that one spark from the bellows can burn the flax? What was the wisdom of this purported wise person? I heard an explanation from my father. The reason why flax is so flammable, I love this idea, is that it is full of air, as opposed to a dense material such as wood, which does not ignite easily, right? Because it's full of air, and therefore fire, it's easier to create the flame. The wise person was not instructing the blacksmith to set the flax on fire. Rather, his point was that the very trait that renders the flax flammable can also serve the blacksmith's question. As an airy substance can be compressed and made to fit into a smaller space that currently occupies. The great volume of the flax is only a mirage. In other words, the flax looks like it's a lot, but it's really not. What's the vast majority of the flax? It is air. And so therefore he's pointing out that you can actually compress the flax. So it might look very big, but in reality, it's just a mirage. Extending this concept to what Yaakov had said, the idea is that although it is true that Esav had many generals, that was only a matter of quantity, not of quality. One intense spark from Yosef is able to defeat them all. So this flax represents this mirage that our enemies look like they're a lot, but really it's a bunch of hot air. It's a mirage, and therefore they're very easy to destroy. He goes on to say, as Jews, we understand that our strength does not lie in numbers. We are the smallest of the nations. It is about the quality, and that is what we bring to the table. This is really the message of Hanukkah. Think about what we say in Al Anisim, right? Rabim biad me'atim, right? Where we see that the many were delivered into the hands of the few. The Gemara makes reference to this, and that is the greatness of the holiday of Chanukah. And so therefore, what this Medrash is reminding us is that while although they dwarf us in size, what ultimately defines our success is not our quantity, but our quality. Let me read you Rabbi Sachs on this very idea. Rabbi Sachs writes, you don't have it, I have it. He writes, the Jewish people are small, but have achieved great things to testify within themselves to a force beyond themselves. It has achieved things that no other nation its size could have ever achieved. Think about what we spoke about, those who came to our conversation with Hillel Fold on Tuesday night. And we started off with the inexplicable miracle that takes place in Israel. Billions and billions of dollars invested in startup, a country the size of New Jersey. It is simply incomprehensible. The success that Israel has had militarily, the success Israel had as a startup nation, the success that it has had financially, all of it's inexplicable, right? We have dwarfed, we have achieved things that no other nation our size could have achieved. Its history has been a living testimony of the force of the divine providence and the impact of its ideals. Israel defies the laws of history because it serves the author of history. Attached to greatness, it became great. Though the Jewish people, God is telling humankind that you do not need to be numerous to be great. You are not defined by your numbers. Rather, nations are defined not by their size, but by their contribution to human heritage. Of this most compelling proof is that the nation as small as the Jews could produce an ever-renewed flow of prophets, priests, poets, philosophers, sages, saints, halachics, agadists, codifiers, commentaries, rebbes, in Rosh Hashivas. It has also yielded the world's greatest writers and doctors and lawyers, etc. You do not need numbers to enlarge the spiritual and moral horizons of humankind. And so you might think that in order to change mankind, you need to be big and you need to be vast. And you have to have as many people as China or whatever. But comes along Rabbi Sachs, comes along Rabbi Weinfeld and says, you need other things altogether. A sense of worth and dignity of the individual, of the power of human possibility to transform the world, and of the importance of giving everyone the best education they could have, and of making each feel part of a collective responsibility to ameliorate the human condition. Judaism asks of us the willingness to take high ideals and enact them in the real world, unswayed by disappointments and defeats. And so ultimately, this Medrash, which is quoted by Rashi, again, Yaakov looks out at the number of people that Esav has, and he says, how in the world am I going to defeat them? They are so large, and I am so small. And Rashi comes along, and he quotes a Medrash. And he quotes a Medrash about flax and how a flame can... And asks Weinfeld, what does the Medrash have to come in to teach us? And he answers that the whole point of the flax is that while it looks big, it's filled with hot air. It's only a mirage. And therefore, because it's filled with hot air, it actually becomes more flammable, so much so that one intense spark is able to defeat them all. And that is the story of Chanukah. That's what we go into Chanukah thinking about. As we refer to the miracles of Chanukah, what do you think Mao Tzor is about? Anyone ever look at the words of Mao Tzor? Each paragraph of Mao Tzor is another story of Gullus. It's a story of Purim, and it's the story of Bavel, and it's the story of Mitzrayim. Each paragraph is a different story in history. And each time we basically say, it makes no sense that we weren't destroyed. Makes no sense that Haman didn't destroy us. Makes no sense that Paro didn't destroy us. Makes no sense that Nebuchadnezzar didn't destroy us. And yet each generation, we had a miracle. Each generation, we had a miracle. And that's the story of this Rashi, is that even though they were so much more numerous than we were, and we were the few and they were the many, nonetheless, we should never count ourselves out. Because what matters is not quantity, but rather what matters is quality. So much so, by the way, that many people in Israel nowadays say that you should add on more paragraphs to Mao Tzor. Why should it be limited to the paragraphs that we have? We should have paragraphs recognizing the miracles of the modern day. And other people say, no, we don't add on to the liturgy. But whether or not you formally add on or not, absolutely, when you're singing Mao Tzor, you should look around yourself at the world today and realize the miracle of the Jewish people. Think about it. Chevra, how many years ago was the Holocaust? 80 years. Okay? If you had told someone 80 years ago, if you had told someone in Poland or Lithuania or in Russia,
in the camps,
if you had told someone that 80 years later, that Jewish life would not only be thriving, would be bursting at the seams, it would be almost unprecedented in Jewish history, that there would be more people learning in kolim, in yeshivos, 80 years later than at any other time in Jewish history, that there would be something called a day school movement. Don't forget, back then, if by 10, 11 years old you weren't an Eloi, financially you had to go to the workplace. There's no such thing as learning in Kollel until you're 23. That's a modern day invention. If you had told people that there would be people learning in Kollel and that we'd have day schools spread around the world and that half the Jewish people would be living in Eretz Yisrael, the person would have thought you were crazy. They would have thought you were nuts. And yet here we are 80 years later. The people who were so devastated and so destroyed, 6 million wiped out, communities destroyed. And yet, you know what we did? I'm going to speak about it again on Shabbos. We put one foot in front of the other, and we rebuilt slowly but surely. And 80 years later, you and I are the proof of arguably one of the greatest miracles in the history of the Jewish people. And that is that 80 years after the Holocaust, here we are with this chus of learning Torah with hot dogs and chulent on a Thursday night in Boca Raton, Florida. Geschmack of Ruchnius. And Gashmias. And so we saw three, I have to get the hot dog in everywhere. So we saw three ideas in 30 minutes. I thought a top five. Some people disagree. The Dudaim Basadeh, Vatis Baseu Bigdo. That sometimes the Itahara tries to get you to hold on to the past, but Vayazov Beged. Sometimes you have to be willing to let it go. We have to be willing, in order to succeed, we have to be willing to not hold on to our mistakes and not hold on to our past failures. We saw the idea from Rabbi Willig, that sometimes in interpersonal relationships, compromise is hugely important. But when it comes to your core values, when it comes to your service Hashem, there have to be lines in the sand that we will not bend on. That our grandparents and great-grandparents lost their jobs every Friday because Shabbos was that important to them. What are those values to us, and are we communicating those to our children and to our grandchildren? And lastly, the message of Hanukkah, the message of the flax, that what defines our success is not our quantity, but rather our quality. It's always been our contributions to the world, our tenacity, our grit, our ability to rejuvenate ourselves, no matter what obstacles and difficulties we ever face. And with that, I wish everyone a good Shabbos and a Freilich and Chanukah.